This is Radioactive Magazine, a KKFI public affairs program of progressive activism, opinion, and commentary. Opinions expressed on this program are those of the speakers alone and are not necessarily the views of KKFI, its staff, volunteers, board of directors, show hosts, or other guests on the program.
You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. The time is 6 o'clock on a Tuesday evening, and Radioactive Magazine, and here's your host, Craig Lubo.
Hey, thank you for joining us. This is Craig Lubo, and my co-host tonight is Kristen Chow. And our topic tonight is immigration. This is a continuation. We had an immigration show back on August 5th, and we have back with us again tonight Angie Williams, and we have Mickey Bouchard.
Yes, that's perfect.
Okay. Both are immigration attorneys, and let's start out with both of you went down to, since our last show, to Artesia Detention Center. So let me start out with Angie, and then both of you can talk about what you did down there.
Well, we both went down along with a couple other people from the community, myself and Mickey, Angela Ferguson, another immigration attorney, Jackie Saavedra, who's a law student here in town, and Robert Sagastumi, who's student at KU for sociology or social work and an activist. And we went down there for a week and worked with the women and their children that are being detained down there at the border, helping to process their asylum claims. And we worked basically. We got there on late Saturday night, and we got up at, I don't know, 7 or 8 in the morning the next day and went to the detention center and worked every day from 7 in the morning until, one or 2 in the morning every single night, helping to do as many intakes as we possibly could for as many women and their children as we possibly could. To help determine whether or not they have viable asylum claims.
Okay, now you said for the women and children, did this detention center not have any men?
No. This detention center is called a family detention center, but it only held women and their children. It didn't have unaccompanied minors, so it didn't have any children that were alone, and it also didn't have any men that were solo or any men and their children. It just had moms and children.
Okay. And so when, in terms of helping them process the claims, what kind of claims were you processing for them?
Well, all of them had asylum claims. And there's I'll let Mickey jump in here and talk a little bit about it, but all of them have asylum claims. And so what we were helping them do, asylum is kind of a long process. When you come to one of our borders and you are fleeing your country for your life because something has gone awry in your country and you are no longer able to be protected within your own country, you can flee your country and you can come to the United States and seek protection. And once you arrive at one of our border points, and in this case, these women all arrived at the southern border point, but really anywhere, like you can come over on a ship or in a plane or in any fashion, arrive physically in the United States and ask an agent who apprehends you or in many cases who you walk up to and say, please help me, I am seeking asylum. It kicks in this whole procedure of things that have to be done in order to determine whether or not you have a viable asylum claim. It's called a credible fear determination process. And I let Mickey jump in and talk a little bit about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, the credible fear interviews are a special part of law that gives anybody, as Angie just explained very well, anybody who comes to the border has the right to have an interview with an asylum officer. They must verbalize their fear to the regular CBP, which is Customs and Border Patrol. They must state that they fear for their life. And when they state their fear, which in my opinion, 99% of them state their fear, whether immigration says it's only 90%. When they verbally declare that they have fear, they have a right to a detailed interview with an asylum officer. And these asylum officers are specially trained, supposedly special trained in humanitarian law, the articles under the convention, the Geneva Convention, articles under the Hague Convention for asylum and refugee law. And these officers do a basic interview that is recorded and transcribed with the applicant. Usually these interviews last about an hour, 2 hours to 3 hours. At this interview, the officer does ask questions. I mean, the officer just doesn't sit there and say, "Why do you fear?" They actually are supposed to ask follow-up and direct questions. So after they have this interview, the asylum officer dismisses the women, usually, which we can talk about all the conditions. They sit there in a room with their children in front of them, and they're asked to discuss why they left, either usually describing horrible domestic violence and abuse that goes underreported in their country, or the police do not prosecute any abusers, or they talk about gang violence or any type of torture in front of their children, usually, in a small room with an officer. And then they leave, and the officer does not approve that. So the women have to go back to their detention halls. And when they come back, or the officer comes back 2 or 3 days later with the determination of whether or not they have credible fear in the eyes of the government. If they do, they get to see an immigration judge. If they don't, they get to see an immigration judge in a limited context. And basically the immigration judge kind of reviews their story and either confirms or revokes the asylum officer's determination. So it's... no attorney. There's not a lot of attorney involvement in credible fear interviews or in the immigration judge review.
Okay. What is their standard of proof, or what type of evidence do they have to show to establish credible fear?
Well, this is just the statements of women who have run for their lives. So they don't, usually, the vast majority of them don't have the documents, like a police report, because a lot of these Central American countries, predominantly El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, do not give out police reports when women complain about the domestic abuse. So the women are coming to the border with nothing. They might have a copy of a police report that they miraculously obtained about the domestic violence. Some of them don't have passports, birth certificates, anything. So they can prove the legal standard. They can give their testimony, and if they're deemed credible, that there's a credible possibility that they experienced persecution or that they will experience persecution, that they can win asylum on just on their testimony alone.
Well, and for the first step, for the credible fear step, it's an extremely low standard. It's purposely set low because of what Mickey just said. And not just, you know, speaking generally, not just with the women and children at the southern border right now, speaking generally in terms of asylum in general, you are talking about people who have fled for their lives, who have maybe hit away on a boat and come over here, or who have come over, you know, on a plane after they didn't know if they were going to be able to get out of their country or some situation like that. The credible fear bar is set very low. All you have to show is that you are credible, is that your story is credible, and there is a reasonable likelihood that you can show some sort of either persecution or torture based on one of the five protected grounds. And the five protected grounds are based on your race, your religion, your national origin, your political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. You do not have to win your asylum claim at the credible fear interview stage. You just have to show that there's a reasonable likelihood that you could win an asylum claim, that it's possible that you could show, not even really that you could win an asylum claim, that you could just show that you are going to suffer persecution based on that. Nationally, we were reading some statistics prior to like the wave of people coming over, and approximately 70% to 80% of credible fear interviews were granted. In Artesia, it was somewhere around 34% of credible fear interviews were granted as positive credible fear interviews. The bar is set purposefully low because we want people to have an opportunity to take time to gather their asylum claim, because those kind of documents take a while to get, and this is not the venue in which to win the asylum claim. This is just that you're story is reasonably believable and that there's a reasonable likelihood that you're going to show some either persecution or torture under the Convention Against Torture on one of those protected grounds.
Okay, now you said 34% were granted artesia. But what was, I didn't follow them, what was the 70 to 80%?
Nationally. Like if you look at not artesia, but, and I think those numbers were probably somewhere in early 2014, those numbers were, and that may be a little bit off, but it was an extremely high number of credible fear interviews are granted. Normally, not looking at artesia. When you look at people that are applying for asylum or ask for a credible fear interview in other situations, not at the southern border, not women and their children, not the wave of immigrants that came over this summer, the vast majority of people that say that they have a fear of returning are found to have credible fear. That doesn't mean they have a winnable asylum claim. It just means that they have a reasonable likelihood that they are going to be, that there could be a connection between what they suffered and one of the five protected grounds. It doesn't mean they're going to win. It just means that
they get an opportunity.
Okay. But is there an indication, or do you have an idea as to why the ones at Artesia from this last wave was so low compared to the national?
Well, I have a theory, and I think, you know, while we were there, the ACLU was there interviewing people and has since we've been there filed a lawsuit on behalf of several women who were there. And they've laid out pretty convincing evidence in their petition that that these women were treated with a different standard, with a harsher standard, more like you have to win your asylum case at the credible fear interview standard, which is unreasonable because they just have, you know, they haven't had an opportunity to gather documents. They've just traveled for hours and hours on various buses. They are asked these questions to explain the horrible things that have happened in front of their children who are sitting on their lap and not asking if their children, you know, if they would like to have their children wait somewhere else before they describe the horrible things that have happened to them. All sorts of due process related violations that we found while we were there and that have that the lawyers that continue to go there have found and that were there before us found. We think that this was and this is what the ACLU has laid out in their lawsuit, that this was a purposeful, dedicated, systematic, you know, push to show that to try to show that these women are economic refugees, that they are coming here just to work and they are not coming here for any legitimate asylum-based reason, and to try to get them out of the country as soon as possible. Well, once the lawyers have gotten in there and have kind of put the brakes on some of that, that has not been the case at all. You know, while we were there, for the week that we were there, we filed many, many motions to reopen. They were granted. Since then, there have been 7 cases that have actually been tried, the asylum case has actually been tried, and all 7 of them have won. So it's not just that these women are coming here to work. It's not that they are coming here for just because their country is poor and that it's better here. It's that they are legitimately fleeing situations that our laws protect under our asylum laws.
Now, when you spoke at UMKC, you mentioned that they can be fleeing from community activities or persecution that doesn't have to be by the government.
Right.
So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, if an individual is claiming asylum and they're claiming it, let's say, specifically gang violence, let's look at the three countries that these women are fleeing from, Honduras, Guatemala, and El Salvador. A lot of these governments have virtually no authority over the individuals there, and the law enforcement agencies in the country are either corrupt or have no power or are paid off by a lot of the local gangs who basically form their own government and their own rule of law, and it's what the gangs say in the streets. If the government cannot control these non-state actors, such as these large gangs that pretty much rule and decide what goes on in the streets, they are claiming asylum based on government inaction.
Yeah.
And it's the government's fault for not being able to control them.
The standard is a person or a group of people that the government is unable or unwilling to control. That could be the government themselves. I mean, in the most, well-known type of political asylum is, I'm someone who's against, like, Fidel Castro, and I protested against Fidel Castro, and so now I'm arrested because I didn't like Fidel Castro. That's a political opinion. The government came in and arrested me because I didn't like that particular type of government, okay? That's probably the most common type of political asylum, but that's only one of the five protected grounds. You also have race, religion, national origin, and membership in a particular social group. Membership in a particular social group is enormous and can encompass practically anything, including many non-state actors like Mickey was talking about. That's where the government is unable or unwilling to control, because in many cases there are non-government actors, as Mickey said, that have basically taken over the country, and they are the ones that actually are controlling much of what's going on, even though they're not officially sanctioned by the government. They're not the actual government. They're a group that the government is unable or unwilling to control.
And a great example of that is really similar to the Cuba case, in a case of asylum. I did a lot of Haitian asylum claims back in 2003, 2004, 2005 in Florida, and they were being persecuted by another political party. The favelas, they were not the Lavas political party. They were attacking others in the street. It might have been the party of the president, but these were independent actors outside on the streets persecuting people because of their political opinion. They were not government actors. They were just supporters, and the government should have controlled these groups. So if these actors can't be controlled, they can. I mean, they have valid claims of asylum.
There was recently a case that's been in the news recently in Mexico where they had around, I think, 200 plus students that were killed, and they determined that it was local police force.
So, it was the mayor. The mayor and his wife.
So just if people are just from that community, would that be enough if they feared because of that to come?
Okay. In my opinion, no, but me and Angie are probably going to disagree.
Well, no, I think actually, no, I agree with that. I think you could make a claim. Now, here's the thing with asylum claims. Asylum is very difficult to win. It is like, it's not one of those claims that you're like, oh yes, you have asylum claim, that's what we for sure do. It's like, we don't have anything else, we should do, I guess we'll go for your asylum claim. If my client has any other avenue other than asylum, I will go the other avenue other than asylum, because asylum is very difficult to win, even in cases that seem like slam dunks. Now, in the case that the example that you gave, just the fact of being from the community is probably not going to be enough. You have to show individual persecution in some way. So just the fact that you live there and it's a bad place and all this stuff happened is not necessarily going to be enough. Now, if you show that you, protested about it, or you have a school-aged child that was supposed to be on that bus but was homesick that day, or that you work in the community and do a lot of youth work or anti-gang work or something like that that could raise attention to yourself, that might be the type of thing that could loop you into a possible social group claim. But just simply living in a place where something bad happened is usually not going to be enough.
And I love that, that you just brought up that Mexico situation, because what happened is that 44 college students that were attending a teaching school, a university training for these individuals that come from a very poor part of Mexico, very indigenous area, were kidnapped by the mayor's wife because she was running for a political position. And so they hired the police to deliver these children over to cartels where they would be assassinated. These 44 kids are, I would say, young adults. I mean, they were college-age kids that were trying to make a, trying to find their way out of poverty. And, you know, they're destined to be on those fields working in the fields for the rest of their life if they don't get an education. And these children tried to do that, and they were actually protesting over, I believe it was just a change in the pension or a change in the way that the local school was run and the funding. I mean, it wasn't, you know, protesting against corruption or protesting. They were just somehow, hurting the mayor's wife's position. And that's why they, I mean, if I were a person from that community, I would somehow try to state that my child is a college student from there and in the teaching school specifically and trying to flee the area. It's so complex.
Here's the other bad thing about that situation is that it was Mexico. And almost no one from Mexico gets asylum. It's Mexican asylum claims are, despite the fact that horrible things happen in Mexico all the time, and they have all the same benchmarks of asylum claims from other countries. You can take the exact two things that happen, one in Mexico and one in Guatemala, and the person from Guatemala has a much better chance of winning because they're from Guatemala. Mexican asylum claims are
99% denied
just because they're Mexican asylum claims. And so that is another reason why that particular one makes it much more difficult.
Okay. And do you have any questions, Kristen?
Go ahead.
Okay.
Well, I'd actually like to hear more about your experience in the detention center and how emotionally what that was like.
Mickey and I actually haven't, I mean, we spend a fair amount of time together, like, here, and we really haven't talked about it. It was really traumatic.
After I got back, I actually went straight to St. Louis to my family after the detention center to spend some time with my mother, and I just couldn't even explain it. I had this anger, but I was also just really, really sad, and I just wanted to be left alone for a few days. I mean, like, it was a really traumatic experience. I mean, we're not getting sleep. We're coming home back to our hotels at 1:30 in the morning. We wake up at 5. We're at the detention center at 6 because the guards have to take us back, and that's about 4 hours of sleep every single night, hearing these horrible stories of rape and abuse, and hearing the guards there, a few of the guards, not all of them, a few of the guards treat these women horribly. It was quite an experience. It took me a while. It took me a while to finally feel
not angry.
Exactly.
I'm glad I'm not the only one that
I stopped cursing. Yeah. I stopped cursing about a week afterwards.
I came home and my fiance is like, "What is wrong with you?" And he's like, "Why are you mad at me?" And I'm like, "I'm not. I'm just angry. I'm just angry about everything." I mean, it was quite traumatic. I wrote these three pieces for Ayla, and they put these three pieces up on their website, and I posted some of them on Facebook. I got probably 24 unsolicited emails from people I had never met saying, "You sound like you have PTSD and probably need to talk to a counselor." I mean, it was really true. I mean, you know, I do criminal stuff, and I do, like, federal criminal stuff, so my clients are accused of big things. They're accused of drug dealing. They're accused of money laundering. They're accused of things that are going to put them in prison for a long time. I also do family-based immigration and deal with very difficult situations. I don't think Mickey does any of the criminal stuff, but she does also family-based immigration. She does some family law things. We both do a type of law that isn't always a pretty type of law. You know, it's a type of law where we deal with ugly stories and hard facts of family and hard facts of life, and I don't think either one of us are strangers to hearing horrible stories. But this was just like, I mean, I usually maybe will hear a horrible story like what we heard 5 or 7 times a day for 10 days in a row, maybe once a month, you know. And this was, it was like being emotionally assaulted all the time, not just with the fact that this was of hearing their stories, which were just horrible. I mean, just hearing their stories was awful, but just what was happening to them as human beings, we ought to be ashamed that this is how we are treating this vulnerable class of people. It is not one of our finest moments.
I have a great example tomorrow. Tomorrow I have a bond hearing with a woman from Artesia who originally got to the government, or got to the detention center, had a case of, she described all of the scars all over her body caused by her husband and how many times she reported him to the police and this fear that she lived in. Even her oldest daughter, who was 15 years old, was there talking about how her own father beat her mother to a living pulp year after year after year. They denied her credible fear interview. They said she didn't have a real fear of returning, even though this man will kill her. Okay. We jumped in. We filed a motion to reopen. That was back in August. Tomorrow is October 29th, and I have the hearing in Denver via telephone to ask for her to finally get out of detention. I mean, these stories go on and on and on.
Well, and, you know, and she said her client tomorrow has a 15-year-old. The majority, you have to remember, the majority of these mothers have children that are under 10. There are mothers that have children that have older teenagers, but the average age of the kids is about seven.
We have just a few seconds left. Just one quick question is, the time process when they come in and they have the credible fear interview to the time that they would have a decision from an immigration judge or an asylum judge, how long, what's the total time that typically takes?
In my case, it's going to be, she got here July 30th, and what's tomorrow, the 29th, so about 4 months, but that is not normal. They should be given bond during this process. So,
Well, I want to thank you then for being here. We've been talking to Mickey Bushart and Angie Williams on immigration law, and Kristen Chow is my co-host. Thank you for joining us, and we will do more immigration in the future.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
And thank you, Craig and Kristen, for this evening's Radioactive Magazine. You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI in Kansas City. Radioactive Magazine is a production of KKFI, and the purpose of it is to allow local activist groups a forum in the Kansas City airwaves. If you or your organization would like to take part in Radioactive Magazine, whether that be provide editorials, commentary, be guest, or speak about different issues, or have ideas for content for Radioactive Magazine, call Dan Connolly at area code 816-217-5875. And again, thanks to everybody who's doing the pledge drive, really helped out Radioactive Magazine and helped out KKFI. And those who were out of state, out of country, out of mind during that time, you're more than welcome to still contribute by going to kkfi.org and make sure you tell them that Radioactive Magazine sent you. Coming up at 6:30 is Counterspin, and the topic this evening, Harriet Washington on Ebola, Carl Canetta on isolationism, and U.S. public policy. 7 o'clock is Manny and Bibiana, and just a pleasant evening of music on KKFI, and I would be remiss if I didn't say, go Royals.